Aside from the mountains, there are coastal plain areas in Italy, and three of those are worth looking at. The first one isn't actually coastal, it's the Po Valley. It's the river valley of that major river in the north of Italy, which offers a very wide expanse, the widest expanse, in fact, in the country of fertile arable land. But also we'll be looking at the plain of Latium, modern-day Lazio, which is immediately to the south of the settlement of Rome. And the Latins, in fact, as we'll see, were to receive the close attention of the Romans for several centuries before the rest of the Italians and ultimately the rest of the inhabitants of the Mediterranean did. South of Latium, around the area of Naples, is the plain of Campania. Campania is extremely fertile because it has Mount Vesuvius located in it. Mount Vesuvius is an active volcano and erupted, of course, most spectacularly in recent memory in AD 79, burying the cities of Pompeii and Herculaneum, leaving us with great archaeological treasure trove. But it also offers the plain of Campania a great agricultural treasure trove of volcanic minerals that makes the place especially fertile because of the slopes of the mountain. It was a very popular place for wine growing in the ancient times. And as an aside, I'll presage some later talk about public leisure and so forth by saying that Campania became the equivalent of the Roman aristocracy's Florida. This is where they went to holiday and relax. It's a beautiful environment. I mean, the famous saying, see the Bay of Naples and die. It's a magnificent physical setting. But also there are naturally hot springs and so forth there. And very quickly, the plain of Campania and the towns around it became holiday resorts for the Roman well-to-do. As to Latium itself, it's bordered on its northern edge, as I've said, by the river Tiber, on its western side by the Tyrrhenian Sea, and on its east and south by mountains. In the centre of the plain of Latium, down the Alban Hills, a low-lying range of hills, which were to be a religious focal point for the people, the early inhabitants of Latium, the Latins. By the time of Roman expansion in Italy, all of these plains and the others I haven't mentioned, all the lowlands of Italy, were well worked by agriculturists. In the mountains tended to reside more pastoral people, but more of that anon. But this was a well-settled region by the time the Romans emerged as a power in the area of Italy. What about the people themselves? Well, with the exceptions of the Greek colonizers in the south and the Etruscans in ancient Tuscany, ancient Etruria, modern Tuscany, the Italian peninsula was occupied by non-urbanized tribal peoples. That means these people did not have large cities. They lived, tended to live in villages, in loose tribal arrangements led by chieftains or clans. They often would have specific sites that they shared for religious purposes, which offered something of a focal point for their cultures. But they were very much living what would be termed by archaeologists an Iron Age lifestyle, tribal, non-urbanized lifestyle. Archaeology is clear to us that the first inhabitants of Italy went back to the Stone Age, but the period before about 400 BC is very difficult to reconstruct. We have fragmentary references by Greeks to the situation in Italy prior to 400, but they're extremely sketchy and, of course, laid over with legends and myth, which makes life very difficult for the historian trying to reconstruct the situation in the era before 400 BC. Our two main avenues into the prehistoric period of Italy are archaeology, unsurprisingly, and linguistics. Archaeology, as we've seen before, is a very valuable tool for the ancient historian, churning up an enormous variety of ancient evidence, ancient artifacts which can be studied. And in the prehistoric period, that means really the period before we have any kind of extant or consistent literary or written evidence whatsoever, archaeology is really all we have to work on. And so, as we've already seen, when looking at archaeology, everything then depends on the interpretation of the data. And I suppose it's safe to say that archaeology offers us two main ways of examining and trying to make sense of the cultural patterns of pre-Roman Italy. One is examination of burial styles, whether the people inhumed their dead, buried them whole, or whether they cremated them. And often cultures can be determined by whether or not they use cremation or inhumation. The other main avenue is pottery styles. Types of pottery, shapes of pots, and decorative techniques on those pots are also used in combination with burial styles and settlement patterns to try and deduce the different classes of people who occupied early Italy. And this course is not about early Italy, so I'm not going to go into tremendous detail about the various types of culture that have been located there. Suffice it to say that now a reasonably good picture of the situation in pre-Roman Italy, in prehistoric Italy, can be now reconstructed. We see people in there from the Stone Age, they continue on into the Bronze Age, and around 1000 BC there's a tremendous growth in the population of the pre-Roman people of Italy. And they start to become more profuse, their settlements become more common, and of course their burials become more common because there are more people to bury. What about linguistic evidence? Well, linguistic evidence is also very useful. So far, at least 40 languages have been identified that were spoken in pre-Roman Italy. 40 languages are dialects of languages. I think that's perhaps more accurate. Languages are dialects, which is quite a lot. These dialects are known to us from often fragmentary inscriptions that have been found inscribed on stone or on pieces of pottery, are in fossils that have been left over in later authors who quote ancient formulae that seem to incorporate these ancient languages. Well, what's the historical significance of the linguistic evidence? What does the plethora of languages and their various classification tell us about the historical processes that determined the population pattern of pre-Roman Italy? That's a much more difficult question to answer. Are we talking about language groups supplanting other language groups because of invasion, because of conquest, or because of trade and emulation, migration, acculturation? What's going on? What's the historical process behind the quilt of pre-Roman Italic languages? That's a matter for debate, and I'll leave that to the experts in the field. I just want to draw your attention to it. As far as we can tell, then, the broad division between the peoples of pre-Roman Italy was that of agriculturalists in the lowlands and often pastoralists, very warlike usually, people living in the hills or foothills of the mountains that are so common across the peninsula. Sometime around 600 BC, a major shift took place in the population of Italy in the north. Starting, it seems, at about this time, people from across the Alps began to infiltrate into the northern part of Italy. These people were Celts, what the Romans called Gauls. Gallic Celtic people, who, as you may or may not know, were in northern Europe very dominant Iron Age culture. The Celts, for what it's worth, seem to have arisen in the area of Austria originally, spread westwards, eventually to occupy most of France, and parts of Germany, Spain, and eventually they moved up into the British Isles, where, of course, they founded the civilization which has given us such wonderful scholars of ancient Rome. But starting around 600 BC, they also began to cross the Alps. And this would have been some feat. Crossing the Alps without there being anything other than goat tracks to follow must have been quite difficult. And exactly again, what's happening? Are these Celtic invasions? Are these large bodies of armed men coming in and taking over the northern part of Italy, the Po Valley? Or are they gradual migrations, filtrations that take place over centuries? Very hard to tell that from the archaeological evidence, which will tend to conflate the evidence, you know, giving you 50 years either side. Well, 50 years is a long time. It's almost two generations of people. What's going on? Very hard to say. What we can say is that by 500 BC, the whole of the Po Valley was occupied by Gallic Celts. In fact, the Romans called it Gallia Cisalpina, which means Gaul this side of the Alps. They classified it as part of the land of the Gauls. And in fact, it wasn't until much later that it became classified as part of Italy. Italia started south of Gallia Cisalpina. So the whole northern plain of the Po Valley was considered by the Romans not to be, at least originally, not to be part of Italy. In the picture of pre-Roman Italy, we have the Celtic Gauls in the north. Then we have the various Italic tribal cultures, chief among them in central Italy, the Oscans, and especially the Samnites. We'll be hearing more about the Samnites in due course, occupying the area to the south and east of Latium. And then in the south of Italy, we have also invaders called Greeks. Well, not quite invaders, they're foreign settlers, people from abroad. What are the Greeks doing in Italy? Well, Those of you who know your Greek history will be well familiar with the period of Greek colonization that started around 800 BC and continued on to about 600 BC. But the intense period of colonization stretching from about 800 to, say, 700 BC, the very intense spread of Greeks and their culture across the Mediterranean world. They went east and west. They went up into the Black Sea and the southern steppes of Russia, and they also came westwards as far as Italy. In fact, some of the earliest colonization movements from Greece took place in Italy. And by the time that the Romans began to emerge as a force to be reckoned with in Italy, the Greeks were well established in the southern part of Italy and in Sicily. But a word on Greek colonies and Greek colonization. Greek colonies were not part of any organized, centralized Greek empire or Greek state. They were not instruments of imperium. They were instead city-states, each one independent of the other, each one with its own laws and governing bodies, foreign policy and coinage and army and so forth. And so these Greek colonies should not be seen as part of a concerted attempt by Greece to take over Italy or anything like that. They are merely a pattern of settlement in the southern part of Italy that would have been well established by the time the Romans emerged on the scene. The Greek colonies that we'd be talking about, I suppose, most commonly are Naples, Neapolis, the new city, which was founded on the coast of Campania, on the mainland. Tarentum, which is down south and east on the southern shore of Sicily. That was to be a very major player in Roman history. And finally, possibly the most powerful Greek city-state anywhere in the Greek world, Syracuse on Sicily. This was a majorly powerful state and one to be reckoned with, and one, in fact, the Romans saw fit, first of all, to ally themselves with before they attempted to take the place over and conquer it. Now, the Greeks are different from the tribal peoples that we've looked at. These are urbanized, highly sophisticated people. Greek culture is a very influential culture. And the process that describes the adoption of Greek ways of doing things or Greek thought and so forth is Hellenization, from the Greek word Hellas, which is how they describe themselves, the Hellenes. Hellenization is the process of people adopting Greek manners. And wherever the Greeks went, people who neighbored them tend to get Hellenized. It tends to be that the simpler culture will emulate the more sophisticated culture. That seems to be a general anthropological principle. And the Greeks were about as sophisticated as the Mediterranean could get at that time. So the influence of the Greeks should not be underestimated. And it seems that sometime around the arrival of the Greeks in South Italy and Sicily, it seems that peoples to the north of Rome became very heavily Hellenized. Pre-Roman peoples called Villanovans, they're called. Strange name. It's the name of the site where the pottery style that defines the culture was found. So they're called Villanovan culture. These people seem to have risen themselves up to civilization and become known to us as the Etruscans. And it's on the Etruscans I wish to focus the last part of this lecture. The Etruscans are often described as mysterious in the popular culture. They're still presented as being somehow mysterious. This view is somewhat understandable, but isn't entirely correct. We have nothing actually from the Etruscans themselves, at least nothing in terms of long literary treatments of their own history or their own culture, like we do for the Greeks or the Romans. We have the tales of outsiders about them. We have the tales of the Romans about them. We have the tales of the Greeks about them. We have archaeological evidence, which is invaluable. And we also have inscriptions in the Etruscan language. You think, well, goodness, if we have inscriptions, don't we have material from the Etruscans? Well, yes, we do, but the problem is we can't read it. It was written in Greek letters, so we can read what the words mean, or at least what they say. We just don't know what they mean. So as a result, bits and pieces of Etruscan inscriptions can be understood, but for the most part, we can't use the material to reconstruct a history of the Etruscans in tremendous detail the way we can for the Greeks or the Romans, for instance. On the other hand, investigation into the Etruscan world in the last 50 years especially has revealed an awful lot to us about them that now makes it possible to say that they're not really all that mysterious. There are still questions about the Etruscans, about their origins, for instance, that we're going to look at, and also about the nature of their control or their influence in Italy. These are certainly valid historical questions, But what Etruscan society was like, broadly speaking, that I think we can now safely say we can present in a reasonably clear way. The ancient view of the Etruscans was that they were immigrants, migrants from the Eastern Mediterranean. This would certainly explain why their language is so odd, since it bears no resemblance to any of the neighbouring languages, any of the neighbouring Italic languages of the ancient peoples bordering the Etruscan lands. So naturally enough, one can say, well, if their language is sort of odd, maybe they brought it with them from elsewhere. And for the longest time, it was considered to be the case that the Greeks and the Romans were right, that the Etruscans were foreigners who had migrated from the eastern half of the Mediterranean, precisely where is unclear, but somewhere in the east, wherever that is, and had settled, for some reason, in the area of ancient Etruria, which is the area immediately north of Rome, bordered by the Tiber River on the south, the Arno River on the north, and by the Apennine Mountains on the east, and the sea on the west. But more recently, a lot of archaeological work has revealed that, in all likelihood, the Etruscans are native Italian peoples called Villanovans who raised themselves up to urbanize civilization, probably under influence, or, well, possibly under influence from the Greeks. Archaeological evidence shows that under all the Etruscan sites, there's a Villanovan site. And there's no sign of any discontinuity of settlement, invasion, burning lairs, or anything like that, for instance, that might suggest that the Etruscans came into a situation aggressively and conquered, as was the old view of the origins of the Etruscans. So I think we can say relatively safely that on best available current evidence, the Etruscans are a native Italian urbanized culture. But under strong Greek influence. That's always important to remember about them. The Etruscans were not a unified people politically. They had city-states. We hear of a league of 12 cities, which seems to have been mutually antagonistic members of this league, who often warred with each other, but could act in concerted effort if threatened, or if much to their advantage. They do seem to have come together for religious purposes, these 12 cities. In other words, this is a very common feature of leagues, especially, say, in Greece, where often antagonistic warring city-states can come together to celebrate festivals, religious festivals, or athletic festivals together. So that's sort of interesting parallel there with the Greeks among the Etruscan cities. The cities themselves appear to have been ruled originally by kings, and again, rather like the Greeks, by the time that the Romans began to encounter them seriously, many of those cities had been undergone revolutions. The kings had been overthrown, and they were now ruled by what are termed oligarchies. There's a technical term to impress people at Thanksgiving dinner. Oh goodness, that's a nice oligarchy you have there. An oligarchy is a rule of a few, of a handful of people, determined either by birth or by wealth, are some other criterion that demarcates the ruling class from the non-ruling class. There's no doubt that the Etruscans exercised a tremendous influence over central Italy. But debate has recently been rekindled as to the nature of that influence. And this is a good example of the sorts of interpretative issues that pervade ancient history that we talked about in the introductory materials. This is an important question. What was the nature of Etruscan control in Italy? It's a very basic question, one that we think that you should be able to answer easily, but actually it turns out to be very difficult. The received view, at least the view that was very common and is still very common, is that the Etruscans exercised a strong political control over Italy from the Po Valley south to Campania. That they exercised this primarily on the western seaboard of Italy, but they did also cross the Apennines and exercise some control in the area of modern-day Umbria. And that this was, if you want to think of it this way, as an empire of the Etruscans, a kingdom of the Etruscans. Now, if you think about the geography that we've just looked at, well, Rome and the Latins will be slap-bang in the middle of that empire. And so at some stage, by the logic of this reconstruction, the Romans must have been ruled by the Etruscans. And yes, people have gone and they have found good evidence, strong evidence, that the Romans were indeed at one stage under the thumb of their northern neighbours. And there's talk of an Etruscan period in Roman history. This is a very common view, and it has got a lot of supporting evidence in its favour. But recently, a very stimulating book was published by Tim Cornell in England. The book is called The Beginnings of Rome, and Tim Cornell challenges this view of Etruscan domination in Italy. He points out inconsistencies in the pattern of Etruscan evidence across the so-called empire. He says, for instance, if we look at the density of inscriptions, so I'll just give you this example. We have obviously lots of Etruscan inscriptions pertaining to important people. One didn't carve an inscription for a nobody. One carved an inscription for an important person. Obviously, we have lots of those inscriptions in Etruria itself, north of Rome. Not very many in Latium, and then a lot again in Campania. Why do we have an Etruscan empire with a big hole in the middle? Why are there so many Etruscans north and south of Latium, but not in Latium itself? He also draws parallels with other archaic cultures, looking at the nature of the upper classes in these archaic cultures and how they often can move around freely among each other across city-state boundaries. There's sort of an aristocratic ethos among many of these early cultures, and he says this does not fit with the notion of an Etruscan dominance. His picture of the nature of Etruscan control in central Italy is that of a sphere of influence. So many of the pieces of evidence that you find for the early Etruscan Empire or the Etruscan Empire in Italy are actually evidence of cultural influence, and that can't be denied. Okay? And so you have in Etruria plenty of Etruscans, and then they move south, passing by Latium, and maybe going by the sea, into Campania, where it's actually extremely pleasant, as I mentioned before, and you find plenty of Etruscans down there, but not too many in the area of Latium itself, which was densely populated and would have been a very difficult place to conquer, as we'll see the Romans found out. Very difficult place to move into militarily and take over. So you so simply bypass it if you're Etruscan. And also what we're talking about then is not so much an Etruscan Empire or an extended Etruscan kingdom in control of central Italy, but rather a sphere of influence, sphere of cultural influence, and undoubtedly political influence as well, but not a centralized state, not a centralized empire. Whether or not Tim Cornell's view will ever be accepted in full is a matter for the scholars to figure out over the next few years. Initial reactions have been mixed. Some people, of course, are horrified to see the notion of Etruscan Rome being so hastily dismissed. And so the issue no doubt will be hotly debated among students of early Rome and of the Etruscans for years to come. But it's interesting that there is such a debate and fully illustrative of what we talked about in the introductory classes of this course. The sorts of things that people argue about in ancient history. Well, the Etruscans were very thoroughly absorbed by the Romans. This is one of the reasons why they were initially considered to be so mysterious. The Romans, drawing the line between the Etruscan and Roman in so many fields, has proven to be very difficult. The Romans themselves tended to look at their own culture and say, goodness, that's an odd feature of the way we do things. Where did that come from? Oh, the Etruscans gave us that. And we don't know if we can trust that statement or not. The Romans just seem to have thrown it out often as, oh yes, that came from the Etruscans. That's why we have temples shaped like that. That's why we look at birds to try and divine the nature of the gods' intent. This is a very strange thing to do, isn't it? You go out and you look at birds feeding, or you look at birds flying. It's called augury. And that way you're able to tell something about the gods' disposition towards this or that endeavor that you're planning to take part in. This is something that the Romans themselves say came from the Etruscans. And in fact, the evidence of tomb paintings and so on, archaeological evidence from the Etruscan sites, would suggest that this is not incorrect. That it seems that the Etruscans were keen on this issue of divination, trying to divine closely the attitude of the gods towards human enterprises. The Romans were also greatly influenced by the Etruscans in the field of statecraft, especially the symbols of power. We'll see those symbols of power when we look at the Roman Republic. But suffice to say now that many of those symbols, for instance the fasces, the rods and axes of office that accompanied Roman magistrates about them, were derived from the Etruscans. And we'll see as well other influences on the Roman polity, at least on the symbols of power, from the Etruscan sources. So, pre-Roman Italy then, a quilt of cultures, a great variety of languages, with some foreigners, Greeks and in the south, Celts in the north, and the whole place, well, not waiting for Rome, but certainly going to experience Rome in no short order in the centuries to come.
Lecture 4, The Foundation of Rome.
Welcome to the fourth lecture in the history of Rome for the teaching company. Having established the due cultural shape of pre-Roman Italy, it's now time to embark on the long story of Rome by beginning at the beginning, the foundation of Rome itself. In this lecture, I wish to outline to you the stories that the Romans themselves preserved concerning the foundation of their city and of their nation. Then we will look at the archaeological evidence for the earliest history of the site at Rome itself and its immediate context. And we will end with a brief examination of one of the themes that we've been carrying throughout this early part of the course, the issue of the limits of archaeological evidence as illustrated by this one question. Under what circumstances and when was Rome founded? We have literary evidence, we have legendary evidence from the Romans themselves, we have archaeological evidence, and let's put the two together and see what we can come up with. Later Romans preserved two tales about the origin of their people and their city. Both of them are well known to most people, I would imagine. One of them surrounds the twins Romulus and Remus, and the other surrounds the Trojan hero Aeneas. I'll deal with each of them in sequence. The story about Romulus and Remus is entertaining, so I'm going to tell it. It's preserved in numerous versions by the Romans themselves. It's typical of such legendary or mythic tales that there are a variety of versions of them floating around the ancient world. The version I'm going to give you is that as recorded by the Roman historian Livy, Titus Livius, who is one of our best, at least one of our extant sources for the earliest periods of Roman history. Livy wrote a vast history of Rome in 142 books. He did so at the time of the Emperor Augustus, so we're talking about the period around 30 BC onwards, maybe working for 40 years on this project. And of those 142 books, about 35 books of Livy's history have survived to us, including the first five, which deal with the very earliest periods of Roman history. So it's an invaluable source, at least for what later Romans thought about the earliest phases of their own history. So what I'm going to tell you now is Livy's version of the story of Romulus and Remus, but I do stress again, there are variants out there, and you may have heard some details that diverge from what I'm going to say, but don't worry if you have. The story starts in Alba Longa, in the plain of Latium, where the king, Numitor, finds himself deposed by his brother, Amulius. The villainous Amulius commences murdering the children of his brother, but spares the niece, Rhea Silvia, making her instead a Vestal Virgin, a calculated appointment, since a Vestal Virgin by nature cannot have children, and no grandsons of Numitor can arise to avenge his usurpation. Rather embarrassingly, however, Rhea finds herself pregnant. Naturally, this is laid at the feet of a god, none other than Mars, the god of war. Not only does she have a son, she has two twins, Romulus and Remus by name. Amulius is horrified and imprisons Rhea and orders the boys drowned. I've always wondered why they go for drowning. It's like the James Bond movies where they always insist upon talking at great length while they're trying to kill the good guy, giving him a chance to get away, rather than just killing the children straight out. No, they have to be drowned. They're placed in a basket, sent down the river, and lo and behold, the basket doesn't sink. It gets washed up on the shores of the river Tiber, where the children, the infants, are discovered by a she-wolf. and suckled, kept alive until a shepherd happens by, brings them home, brings the children home, and raises them to adulthood. As young men, Romulus and Remus perform all sorts of great deeds. They go around being brigands on brigands, for instance. They live a sort of Robin Hood type lifestyle, robbing the robbers. But rather than distributing the loot among the poor, they just keep it and distribute it among their friends. Eventually, however, this sort of behavior draws the attention of the king, and Remus is captured and brought before Amulius as a brigand, and then sent over to Numitor, who appears to have been a sort of country squire living in relative obscurity. Exactly why he's sent over there is not made crystal clear, but he is sent over there, and then a very important moment happens. Here is Remus standing before Numitor, and it becomes clear to everyone, this is no brigand. A brigand doesn't have that stature, that noble profile, or that fine character. And yes, the shepherd reveals, I've always suspected that maybe these two children were something special. I found them being suckled by a she-wolf. Oh, how long ago was that, says Numitor? This long ago. My goodness. Everything falls into place and it becomes clear that Romulus and Remus are the sons of Numitor. They organize a coup and depose Amulius. In fact, they kill him just for good measure and reinstall Numitor as the king of Alba Longa. So far, the whole story then revolves around the internal politics of Alba Longa. Here's where a rather tenuous link comes into play. It suddenly grabs the twins that they feel the urge to go and found a new settlement. So they truck along to where the basket was washed ashore. It just happens to be below the slopes of a hill called the Palatine, which is in the center of modern Rome. And there they found a settlement. But the tale ends in tragedy, because Romulus and Remus quarrel over the new settlement. The two most common reasons given for the quarrel in the ancient sources are that they quarreled over the naming of the settlement. Romulus wanted it named after himself. Remus wanted it named after himself. Presumably, if Remus had won, we'd be talking about the great city of Reims on the Tiber. But Romulus won the argument in a fashion that has proven most effective in settling arguments throughout history. He killed his brother. The other source for the argument is that Remus mocked the growing walls of the town by jumping over them, by showing how small they were, and this irritated Romulus so much that in a fit of rage, he killed his brother. So Romulus then stood alone as the founder of this new settlement called Rome, and he also became its first king. There we have the Romulus and Remus story, immortalized in all kinds of famous images, including the wonderful Capitoline wolf bronze statue today in Rome, in the Capitoline Museum in Rome. It's an Etruscan statue of the wolf, which really attests the antiquity of this tale. The statue must date to about 600 BC, although the two suckling babies that are a feature of the statue were added in the Renaissance period. But the idea that a wolf is the image of Rome clearly shows that this is a very ancient tale. And indeed, folklorists would agree. They would argue that this has got all the hallmarks of a classic local indigenous folklore legend of the sorts that we find repeated again and again in various cultures all around the globe, not just in the Mediterranean. We have special children, royal children who were denied their birthright. There's then an attempt to kill those children by some kind of villainous ruler. The children escape miraculously and end up being raised by animals or people of lowly birth. But eventually their true character shines through and they come back into the story to seize control of their destinies and undo the wrong that was done them and their family in the past. Such images can be found if we just think of the biblical context from Moses right through to Jesus himself. After all, Herod attempted to kill this supposed king of the Jews and so forth. All these stories, these images, motifs are found repeatedly in folk stories from Africa to Polynesia in various degrees. And as a result, folklorists, most historians, have agreed that this is the original founding legend of the Romans. This is the story that they originally had, the oldest one, to explain where they came from. The other legend that the Romans preserved about their past comes from a rather different source. And it focuses on the Trojan War. Now, those of you, again, familiar with Greek culture will be aware that the Trojan War is one of those formative events in the Greek communal mentality. It is the focus of the two great epics, national epics of the Greeks, the Iliad and the Odyssey. It is the source of many of their values. And it is the source of some of the great stories from Greek legends. Helen of Troy, the enormous expedition over to Troy, Achilles, and so forth, great dueling heroes of the past fighting for honor and country. So this is very much a Greek story, and the other Roman foundation legend derives from this source, because according to this legend, Aeneas, the last survivor of Troy, following the destruction of the city when it was captured by the Greeks through subterfuge, he flees his burning city, carrying his father on his shoulders, leading his son by his hand, and takes off in a boat and sails across the Mediterranean, undergoing all kinds of wonderful adventures, before settling on the coast of Latium and founding the city of Lavinium on the coast of the plain of Latium in Italy. He also fights various local kings, makes alliances with some kings. The whole legend gets elaborated into an epic story that is most famously commemorated in the Roman national epic poem, the Aeneid, i.e. the poem about Aeneas, which is a fine read if you ever get a chance to read it. This is clearly a Greek legend. This is clearly a Roman origin story that is attempting to tie in with Greek culture. And for the longest time it was believed, well, it can only really have come into popular appeal among the Romans when they were really trying to emulate Greek culture, probably in the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. But as we've seen, the Greeks have been present in Italy from at least 800 BC. The Romans, who were familiar with the Etruscans, they were neighbours of them, would have been well familiar with Greek culture long before the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. And so in all likelihood, this story of Aeneas goes back also to the distant past of the Romans. Probably not as far as the Romulus and Remus legend, but certainly not as recently as the 3rd or 2nd centuries BC. And recent archaeological discoveries at the site of Lavinium, the town founded by Aeneas, would suggest that Aeneas was being worshipped there as a god as early as the 4th century BC. So it certainly seems to be the case that this legend is older than many have so far assumed. But there was a problem. How do we unite these two stories? Some people had a vague notion that Romulus and Remus were the grandsons of Aeneas, for instance. Well, there's a problem there, because the Romans had already probably arbitrarily decided that the date for the foundation of Rome was 753 BC, but the Trojan War had taken place around 1200 BC. So not unless Romulus and Remus or Aeneas were exceptionally long-lived, they couldn't be the grandsons. They couldn't be in a grandfather-grandson type relationship. And the solution that was reached, at some stage we're not quite clear, but it was certainly reached by Livy's day, by making the relationship between Aeneas and Romulus more distant. Aeneas founds Lavinium. His son, Ascanius, also known as Iulus, founds Alba Longa. Out of the kings of Alba Longa, as we've seen from the Romulus and Remus legend, emerge Romulus and Remus. We have a nice united cycle now of stories of our origins. And as a result, they're very, very cleverly united into a single saga. In the nutshell then, in the ancient view, Aeneas founded the Roman people. Romulus founded the city that the Roman people were to flourish in. Great tales, very entertaining. How historical are they? Well, that's the $6,000 question. Archaeological evidence suggests a somewhat different picture for the origins of Rome. The site of Rome is itself very advantageous. It's located on a series of hills and spurs of hills overlooking a natural ford in the river Tiber, where there is a island. It's the only island, in fact, in the stream of the Tiber, I believe for its length, at least close to the sea. And so it's a natural place to ford the river. And the evidence would suggest that this spot, being very easily defensible, allowing the people who occupied it to control traffic that goes across the river in the north-south axis, and also to control traffic that goes inland, upstream, against the stream of the river inland, or else down from the inland regions out towards the sea. This is going to give the people who occupy this site a strong advantage over their neighbours, and as a result, it's an attractive place to settle. It seems that the first signs of human settlement from the archaeological evidence date to about 1500 BC, They're not signs of permanent settlement, but human presence. There are some burials and some pottery sherds and so forth. It isn't until about 1000 BC that the first signs of permanent settlement show up. Excuse me, this is when the burials show up, at about 1000 BC. The previous evidence was just pottery sherds, which could have gotten there anyway. They could have been there by ships or boats that crashed and people got out and dropped their pots and broke them. Or it may have been the temporary staging post in the river or something like that. But the first permanent settlement, as evidenced by burials, which indicates now people saying we're going to claim this land as our own and bury our ancestors here, that dates to about 1000 BC. It seems, to summarize the archaeological evidence, it seems to be that originally the settlements on the hills were independent villages. The nature of these villages, who the people were who occupied them, their interrelationships among each other, and the relationships with their neighbours are all things that we cannot reconstruct from the archaeological evidence. But it does seem to be that each settlement had its own defensive perimeter and so forth, and was very much its own place. And that at some stage, at some early stage, dates now are really impossible, these separate villages coalesced into a single community. Now this is a process that we have parallels for in Greek history. It's called by the rather odd-sounding term synoikism, and it means a living together, a coming together into a community, and is found in archaic communities in Greece at about this time. It's usually the result of a rise of population, a localized rise of population that makes villages and communities that are in proximity to each other but are separate from each other coalesce into a single entity. In the 1930s, spectacular finds were made on the Palatine Hill. Excavations there revealed holes. You think, well, what's spectacular about holes? Well, they were post holes. Post holes carved into the rock of one of the outcrops from the Palatine Hill. And the post holes conformed to a model of a hut, an early wooden hut into which these posts would have been placed. The hut is made from the posts being placed in the ground, then the walls built around the posts, the roof put over the top of the posts. And in fact, from the burials in Latium, we can tell what these huts look like, because these ancient peoples of Latium liked to bury their dead. They would cremate them and then bury them in urns shaped like the houses that they lived in. They're called, rather unimaginatively, hut urns. But you can see, if you examine a photograph of one of these hut urns, it has a distinctive type of roof, sort of a vaguely oval shape. Other models, other examples of these huts have been found that show the posts in the walls and so on. And when this is added to the post holes on the Palatine, well, they come together. And we seem to have found evidence of the first settlement in Rome. At least this is what the archaeologists of the 1930s felt. It's worth bearing in mind, of course, who was ruling Italy in the 1930s and why it is that they might have wanted to find evidence of the earliest settlement in Rome, but that's a different matter. The dating of these huts on the Palatine was set at about 750 BC. And if we remember that legends say that Rome was founded by Romulus and Remus in 753. Well, hey presto, we've confirmed the story of Romulus and Remus by finding a settlement of huts on the Palatine Hill. Also, interestingly, we hear from ancient written sources, later sources, that the Romans themselves maintained on the Palatine a reed and stick hut, which they called the Hut of Romulus. They maintained a little shrine cared for by priests of this ancient hut, which was surrounded by all kinds of magnificent buildings in later years, but the site itself was always preserved as the original house of Romulus. And we are told by our ancient source, in this case a man called Dionysius of Halicarnassus, there's a mouthful, that if ever the hut collapsed or was damaged, it would always be rebuilt with the same materials that it had originally been built in. So you put it all together, and the archaeologists of the time thought, well, here we go, we have the hut of Romulus. Well, do we? The archaeological evidence then, in sum, gives a somewhat different picture if we look at the whole of it from the stories of the legends. What we have is a picture rather not of instantaneous or immediate settlement, as the legends would have us believe, Romulus deciding to go out and found a town and going out and doing it on a virgin spot, but rather the archaeology paints a picture of gradual settlement, settlement over perhaps a total of 800 years. Maybe the place being used as a staging post for trade originally, and then gradually attracting settlement. Those settlements being separate villages on the hills, which eventually coalesced at some unknown period into a single community. It's a gradual process, evolutionary process, rather than the single foundation of a town, as the legends would have us believe. But I think it's more important to appreciate that the problem with the archaeology versus the legendary evidence goes deeper than that. It goes to the very soul and heart of the limits of our ancient material. We have on the one hand stories, as I say, wonderful and entertaining stories. We have on the other hand post holes, potsherds, burial urns, and signs of settlement. And in some ways, never the twain shall meet. Just because Aeneas has discovered to have been worshipped at Lavinium in the 4th century BC does not confirm the Aeneas legend. All it tells us is that the people of Lavinium in the 4th century BC worshipped Aeneas, who was supposed to have been around, after all, 800 years earlier. Just because we have huts, simple-looking huts on the Palatine Hill that appear to date to the 8th century BC, does not tell us that Romulus and Remus were sent in a basket down the River Tiber and suckled by a she-wolf, found by a shepherd, and rose to prominence at Alba Longa. In other words, archaeology cannot confirm legends. It cannot confirm them. And in fact, more recent studies of the huts on the Palatine show that in their earliest phases they may go back to about 1000 BC themselves, maybe 900. So the date, even the date of them, as coinciding with the date of the stories about Romulus and Remus, can now be called into question. And I think to a certain degree, asking archaeology to confirm this or that legend is, well, it isn't only unfair to archaeology, it's also unfair to the legend. Because, after all, the function of these stories is not so much for the ancients themselves to give an accurate historical account of their past, but rather to give them a shared sense of communal belonging, a shared sense of origin, which they could say, well, we're all ultimately the sons of Romulus and the sons of Aeneas. We're all ultimately descendants of Troy and the Trojans. And as a result, that's the most important thing about the legends. Not whether or not Romulus or Remus lived, not whether or not the archaeology can confirm or not these ancient stories, but that they served a very important function for the ancients themselves. These stories, colourful stories of their past. I should point out that while the archaeological evidence cannot confirm ancient evidence, or it cannot confirm legendary evidence, it certainly has the power to disprove it. For instance, if we go back to our stories, if we go back to the Aeneas, Romulus, and Remus cycle, what do we have? We have Aeneas founding Lavinium when, well, it would have been around 1100 BC, 1100 to 1200 BC, sometime after the Trojan War, given his wanderings across the Mediterranean. Then we have Aeneas' son, Ascanius, founding Alba Longa in Latium at some stage after that, perhaps 30, 40, 50 years later, if we want to take an extreme possibility and go to 50 years after Aeneas, Alba Longa is founded. And then we have Romulus and Remus, what, some 400 years after that, founding the site of Rome. Well, archaeology can go to these sites and examine the archaeological record at all of these sites. And it's quite clear that Lavinium and Alba Longa are not markedly older than Rome. There's no evidence that Alba Longa was around for 400 years before the site of Rome was. So as a result, it seems most likely then that these stories are, well, in their current form, they're cultural constructions of the later Romans to explain their origins. And their historical truth was a really of little interest to the Romans themselves. They simply believed them as being valuable tools to explain their ancient past, and I think perhaps we should approach them in the same way. So that is the story of the foundation of Rome. It's a very useful test case to examine the relative merits of archaeological evidence over written and legend, especially legendary evidence. I'm not going to be harping on this throughout the entire course, the issue of the limitations of archaeological evidence. I think we can perhaps put that theme to bed now. But it is certainly a good example, a good place to end with the theme that we rose brought up at the start of this course about the various limitations that is placed upon us by the ancient evidence. And as a result, I suppose when we look back on those stories, we should appreciate them for what they were as far as the Romans were concerned, appreciate them as communal legends of a shared origin. And looking ahead at the period that's known as the regal period, the period of the kings initiated by Romulus in legend, we can continue to say that the sources for Roman history for this very early period are very dubious indeed. The written evidence we have is really, as I say, from Livy. He's our main written source. But the question is, what source did he have available to him? Here he is writing a history of a period as remote to him as the early Middle Ages are to us in many ways. Where is he getting his information from? And this raises all kinds of interesting historiographical questions that we can't go into in great detail. But I suppose the fairest answer to offer is that Livy was reporting legends, many of them preserved within major, noble, aristocratic houses in Rome itself, and also shared by the community. Many of the stories about the kings, as we'll see in more detail in the next lecture, are of this legendary, I won't say mythic, but certainly legendary character. The individual reigns of each of the seven kings of Rome, yes, seven is that magical number, and there are seven kings of Rome, they have a particular character to them that reflects the legendary nature of the evidence. And to look even further ahead, I can say, inform you now, that the hard evidence for Roman history only starts to get really good in the period around the beginning of the First Punic War in 264 BC. So for the first 500 odd years of Roman history, our evidence is very patchy indeed. We have archaeology, but the literary material is patchy, questionable. And as a result, the debates among modern scholars about many of the issues that we're going to be discussing over the next few lectures are very intense, and the interpretations more divergent than they are for the later period.
Lecture 5, The Kings of Rome.
Hello, and welcome back to the History of Rome with the Teaching Company. Last time we reviewed the stories about the foundation of Rome, the traditions that the Romans themselves told about the foundation of their city, and we ended the lecture with the brief look ahead into the period that's known as the regal period, the period when kings ruled Rome, which is traditionally said to run from 753 BC to 509 BC. It's on that period that I wish to focus our attention today in this lecture. First of all, we'll review the traditions that the Romans told about the seven kings that were supposed to have ruled in this period. Then we'll recap in a little bit more detail an issue that we raised briefly at the end of the last lecture, which is the nature of the sources for this regal period, particularly the sources that were available to our sources, i.e. what ancient sources were available to our main author, Livy, who was writing about this very early period. We'll then note something of the general characteristics of Roman kingship as it's handed down in these traditions. And then we'll turn our attention to the more heated question of what the historicity is of these stories. How reliable are these traditions? What do scholars say about these stories? And we'll end in even more troubled waters with the issue of Etruscan Rome, raising once more the ugly question of whether or not the Etruscans conquered and controlled Rome. All our Roman sources are unanimous that Rome was initially ruled by kings. they number the kings as seven, the first one being Romulus. Romulus, we saw, was the founder of Rome, but he also became its first king. He helps to consolidate the city in various ways. He initiates wars with the immediate neighbors of the Romans, particularly the people known as the Sabines, or Sabines, who he invites to a party in Rome and then robs all their women in an event known as the Rape of the Sabine Women, because it seemed there was a dearth of females in the fledgling state, and Romulus figured that this was a good way to solve the problem. This rather impetuous act caused war with the Sabines, and then eventually, interestingly, peace. A peace treaty was reached between Romulus and the king of the Sabines, and the Sabines were incorporated into the Roman ethnic body. So there's a tradition then, at the very foundation of Rome, there is some sort of an ethnic meld between the Romans themselves, who were originally founding the town from Alba Longa, and the locals, the Sabines, who were there when they showed up, which makes for rather an interesting situation. Anyhow, Romulus, upon his death, becomes a god. He ascends into heaven and enters the pantheon of Roman gods as the founder of the Roman people. The second king in our traditional line of kings is a man called Numa Pompilius. There's a name for your firstborn. Numa Pompilius is presented to us as having essentially created all of Rome's religious institutions. He founds a whole variety of major cults and colleges of priests who were very powerful and prominent in later Roman society. Chief among these priests, and we'll be hearing a lot more about these particular men, are the pontifices, the pontiffs, who are the chief college of pagan priests in ancient Rome. But there are others, I won't bore you with the details, but there are others, all of whom Numa Pompilius is supposed to have established during his reign. Following the religious zeal of Numa Pompilius comes Tullus Hostilius, the aggressive Tullus. And he lives up to his name because he goes around bashing up on Rome's neighbours in no short order. For instance, he destroys Alba Longa, which is the mother city of the Romans, if you want to think of it that way. After all, the line of Romulus had come from Alba Longa. Now the new state of Rome goes out and destroys the mother city in its expansion into Latium. But lots of other Latin neighbours of the Romans suffer under the aggressive policies of Tullus Hostilius in the tradition, and he helps expand Rome's borders, beginning the long process of conquest of the Latins. The fourth king is known as Ancus Marcius, and he's presented in the wake of the actions of Tullus Hostilius as more of a consolidator. He founds colonies, specifically, and most importantly, the colony at Ostia, at the mouth of the Tiber, on the sea, which was to become Rome's chief port. Rome is not on the sea, it's on the Tiber River inland, and Ostia is down, actually, at the estuary of the Tiber River, and Ancus Marcius is supposed to have founded that colony, which is to become a very important place in later Roman history. But there are other places that he founds as well. He basically goes around building on the achievements of Tullus Hostilius. For instance, he bridges the Tiber. He's the first one to put a bridge across the Tiber. That's the sort of thing that Ancus Marcius does. These first four kings are often called the Latin or Sabine kings because they all seem to have derived from the native community of now the Romans and their Sabine partners. And the last three kings of Rome, at least two of the last three kings of Rome, have rather different origin. Two of them are called Tarquinius. Tarquinius Priscus, who is the fifth king, and Tarquinius Superbus, who is the seventh and final king. Between them is a man called Servius Tullius, who is not of the same ethnic origin as Tarquinius, Priscus, and Superbus. Why do I talk about Tarquinius? Because Tarquinius means the man from Tarquinii, which is an Etruscan town. And the traditions about Tarquinius Priscus are that he was originally called Lucumo, a man from Tarquinii who moved to Rome and established himself and his family as a prominent force in Rome and eventually became king there. In other words, Tarquinius Priscus is an Etruscan. These three kings are often called the Etruscan kings, or at least the period of Etruscan control in Rome. This is some of the chief evidence for those who believe in the Etruscan period of Roman history. It must be said that the ancients themselves show considerable confusion over the traditions about Tarquinius Priscus and Tarquinius Superbus. Tarquinius Priscus just means the first Tarquin or the prior Tarquin, and Tarquinius Superbus means the arrogant Tarquin. More about him in a second. And they show quite a bit of confusion between the two. In some cases they seem to do much of the same sort of thing. Basically, what they seem to do is do a lot of building. They